All right, welcome. It's 1:30. I'm Thaddeus Pope. I'm at Hamline University School of Law and a new board member. The unbefriended must not be unprotected, organizational and clinical management of patients without surrogates. For those of you listening on the recording, the room is filled beyond capacity. So we have three panelists this afternoon. There's me, and what I'll do is identify the problem of the unbefriended, the nature and scope of that problem. Then Barb Daly will turn to discuss a solution to that problem that's been implemented at University Hospitals in Cleveland. And then finally, Marty Smith will discuss a solution that's been implemented at the Cleveland Clinic. Okay, so first on terminology, this is a little bit contested like a lot of terms in bioethics. I think we're using the term unbefriended. Other terms include unrepresented patients, adult orphans, patients without proxies, patients who are incapacitated and alone, but they pretty much mean the same thing. But let me just be clear about the definition, about the target here. And I'm going to give you a definition which has three conditions. First condition, we're talking about patients who lack decision-making capacity, so they're unable to participate in their own healthcare treatment, at least contemporaneously. Second condition is these patients have no available and applicable advanced directive or POLST. And the third condition is that, in addition to those two, these patients have no reasonably available, authorized surrogate decision maker. Okay, so those are our three conditions to define the population we're talking about. Now, just let me unpack that third condition for a second, right? When we say that they don't have an available surrogate, that can mean either that they never completed an advance directive, never appointed a durable power of attorney for healthcare, or maybe they did, but that person who they named is not available. Secondly, what we mean is, ideally, you'd have an appointed agent selected by the patient. Also, there may be a default surrogate list in your state, but either there's nobody who fits any of the categories on that priority list. And then third, it means there's additionally no reasonably available guardian or conservator, a court-appointed surrogate. So in short, there's nobody, the patient herself, and there's nobody else to consent to treatment on behalf of this patient. So that's the problem. And it's a big problem. And so these are estimates. I don't know that any of them are super precise, but that the ABA estimated that this is 3 to 4% of the U.S. nursing home population. That's about 1.5 million people, so if you do the math, that's over 50,000 unbefriended residents of long-term care in the United States. Other estimates, 16% of ICU admissions, that's a big number, or 5% of all ICU deaths, and that's about 500,000 ICU deaths in the United States, so that's another 25,000. Anyway, bottom line, it's a big population, between 50 and 100,000, at least according to the available estimates. And so not only is it a big problem, it's a growing problem. Among other things, if you look at who it is that's unbefriended, right, it's the homeless, the mentally ill, and especially the elderly. Well, there's going to be a lot more elderly, right, as we all know, is over the next 10, 15, 20 years. You can see the slope in the part that I highlight with the box, right? Going to be a lot more extremely elderly people, 85 plus and 75 plus, in the next decade or two. Going to be more unbefriended patients. And then if you look at one of the other drivers for why people might be unbefriended, again, if you remember, most surrogates are going to be family members, and usually it's going to be a child. Well, there's a lot fewer children in the United States, as in a lot of countries. And again, if you just look at the slope over the last decades, a lot more women are childless as compared to past years. And those women are now getting into the age brackets where they might be unbefriended patients. So that, and as people age into this population, another reason why the population of unbefriended is going to grow. It's already big. It's going to grow. Now, to some degree, the law is a causal factor here. So to some degree, it's just the personal circumstances of these patients, the way in which they lived. But the law is actually a big causal factor. And of course, we have 56 different jurisdictions in the United States, and the degree to which the unbefriended is a problem in any given jurisdiction varies a great deal. And just to pick two of the factors here, one is the scope of default surrogate lists. Okay, so just to give it, here's an example, right, is you often, it goes in this order, often this order of priority, where the first default surrogate is the spouse, and it goes down from there. So a subset of states includes something at the bottom, which I highlighted, a close friend, right? And the idea here is that the broader and more expansive the scope of the default surrogate list, the less likely that patient is going to be unbefriended, because there's more people who are going to be qualified or authorized to be a surrogate when the scope of the default surrogate list is wider. And then the other causal factor from the law is whether or not there is, even exists, a public guardian system, which doesn't exist in every state. Because at the end of the day, if you don't have somebody who the patient appointed, you don't have a default surrogate, then you have to go to the court to appoint somebody. That's not even available in every state. And even in the states where it is, or I would say most of the states where it is, that's a very slow process. It's a very expensive process. And sometimes you can't even really, there's no available guardians to serve. Even though the process there, the system is there, the guardians are not. Okay, so that's, where are we then? That brings us to this problem, which is we have somebody who has at least, they have indicated treatment, at least physiologically indicated treatment. We don't know what their preferences are. But there's nobody to authorize that treatment. Now there's three ways, simplifying for sake of time, but there's three basic ways you could respond to this. One way, and these are all ways that are actually used, one way is you just don't give them the treatment, right? You think they need something, but you're not going to give it to them because you don't want to proceed to with an intervention without any authorization or consent. And then maybe eventually that condition will get worse and worse and worse, and it'll become emergent, and then you can go ahead and treat on the basis of the emergency exception or the patient's implied consent. Not a real hot way to go, but it happens a lot. Second pathway to take is the most dominant pathway, and that's where the physician just acts without consent. In other words, she basically consents to her own recommended treatment plan. There's no third party authorizing the treatment. This is the most common approach, but many, many people don't think this is a really wise approach, because we know that physicians have all sorts of biases, whether they're from invidious biases relating to race or socioeconomic status, to biases pertaining to treatment intensity. The physician may have conflicts of interest depending on the way in which this care is being reimbursed. And the fact that you don't have to articulate and explain your recommended treatment plan to another party to get their consent means maybe you don't have to think through the recommended treatment plan as carefully, because you don't have to explain it to a third party, right? Even coming here, I had to think through a little bit more to explain it to you. So people think that this creates risks of bias, risks of conflict of interest, and risks of more careless decisions when you don't have a third party consent. Now, we know that in general, in bioethics, in general, as the vulnerability of the patient increases, the amount of oversight also increases, right? Think in the research context with pregnant women, prisoner population, and so forth. But in fact, here, instead of being positively correlated between vulnerability and oversight, in general in the United States, when we talk about decision-making for unbefriended patients, it's inverse correlation. These are the most vulnerable people. They can't speak for themselves. There's nobody else to look out for them. And they get less oversight than everybody else. So it seems backwards. Which brings me to the third approach, which is going to be my transition here to Barb. If we're going to reject that approach of under-treatment, where we're just not going to provide treatment because we don't have consent, and we're going to reject the solo physician approach, then what we're going to have is an approach where we develop a mechanism that provides some level of scrutiny, some level of vetting of the attending's recommended treatment plan. And the challenge here, and I didn't clear this with her, but the one problem here is this is not authorized in law, okay? So in other words, this idea of these other special mechanisms, only a handful of states actually authorize these special mechanisms to have any decision-making power. So in a sense, since the law isn't really getting the job done, you sort of have to act outside the law. I had a Charles. People remember Charles Bronson from the 70s, right? Okay. But I thought that was a little too dark. And I don't know if you've been introduced as Batman, but in a sense, I think that what hospitals and facilities have to do is basically create their own intramural mechanisms, even though there isn't actual explicit authorization for them to do that. So they're sort of like Batman. So I'm going to turn it over to Barb.
See,
I hope you take that the right way. I mean, people like Batman.
Thanks, Thad. It's quite a start. So what I'm going to do is tell you about the process we used at University Hospitals in Cleveland and just walk through and unpack a little bit of some of the points that Thad raised and go over a little bit of the pro and con for that. We started this in about 2005, facing the problem that I suspect many of you face at your hospitals. The routine low burden things when we get somebody in who can't speak for themselves and no family members and they need IV antibiotics, we presume consent for that. Emergency interventions, I think most of us are reasonably comfortable with. You get a trauma in, you do what you need to do to save the patient's life. But we were seeing these fairly regular cases, maybe 10 a year or so, where it wasn't an emergency, but clearly the patient could benefit from some intervention. But we had nobody to consent. So we formed a task force from our ethics committee. And we sort of, walked through the process, going back to the basics, thinking about, what ordinarily justifies us laying hands on a patient, doing the nasty things to them that we routinely do. And ordinarily, of course, we go on our favorite principle of autonomy, as long as we have somebody telling us it's okay, and medical judgment that it's reasonable to expect it to be beneficial. But, of course, we don't have our favorite autonomy to rely on. So that took us to thinking about, well, what are the ethical standards that we normally rely on when we allow one person to make a decision for another? How is it, given our love affair with autonomy, that we ever let one adult decide for another? And these are, I'm sure, familiar to you all. There's no legal basis in Ohio, my state, with the exception of one section of the our DNR statute where it talks about authorizing treatment withholding. But other than that, there's nothing. So we rely on these assumptions that a family member can act as a reporter, often can tell us what the patient expressed as a previous preference. Even if the patient hasn't spoken, we assume they come from similar culture, values, religion, what have you, so they can do a good job at substituted judgment, our next preference for decision making. And even if they aren't necessarily from the same culture, we assume that a family member has a pretty sole commitment to best interest of the patient. They at least can speak for that patient. And in many cases, they're a stakeholder. They're going to be caring for this patient afterwards, so they have a vested interest. Now, obviously, these don't always hold, and you've all seen family members where you think they're not acting in the patient's best interest. But in general, this is the moral basis for why we let any one adult decide for another. So this is sort of the model that we thought we ought to aim for. And, of course, in these situations of patients who have nobody, all of these are absent. There's no reporter. The people in the hospital in general are quite dissimilar in terms of culture and religion. I think it's safe to assume we are committed to the patient's best interest, but as Thad mentioned, we have the potential for conflict. And I think that's particularly true in today's, particularly acute care systems, where there's such pressure for move the patient on, get them through, move them out of the ICU and what have you. And we're not stakeholders. We don't have to take care of that patient afterwards. So, you know, relying on us is problematic. The conventional options that Thad pointed out, court-appointed guardian, assuming the patient would want everything, we could authorize one or two physicians, or we could refer all cases to the full ethics committee. And we're fortunate that we've had a fairly robust ethics committee for, 40 years almost now. So we have a good mechanism in place. So our task force went through a kind of pro and con for all these options to come up with our eventual solution. Guardianship has the advantage of it is unbiased. This is somebody who has no connection to the hospital. They're not typically from a medical background, so they don't have that cultural bias. And once you have a guardian, of course, guardian trumps everybody. So it's very clear the guardian has decisional authority. Unfortunately, it's not always available. And in fact, in our county, Cuyahoga County, the probate court who does guardianships will not hear these cases. They do not think it's appropriate to get a guardian just to make a medical decision. So that's not even an option for us. It takes time, can be weeks, filing fee. And when you think about it, even if the court was willing to appoint a layperson as a guardian, what would they do? Well, they'd come to the hospital, they'd talk with us, we'd give them advice, and they'd make the decision we advised, probably. So it seems not to serve much purpose. And I don't, you know, although the formal charge of the guardian, of course, is to act in the patient's best interest, there's growing evidence the guardians always don't do so good with this. You know, and this is not just court-appointed, I mean, lay people guardians, but family guardians. There's growing evidence about abuse of people who have that guardianship because it is such a powerful position. So we didn't like that option. Assuming the patient wants everything, well, it might be safest in the sense of, you know, if we're uncertain whether a patient would want a life-sustaining intervention, it does seem like we ought to err on the side of assuming the patient would want it. And in terms of liability, if we do treatment, we don't have to worry about a family member showing up and saying, well, why didn't you take him to surgery? On the other hand, there's lots and lots of data that says, in fact, patients do not want all available treatments. They make very nuanced decisions about benefits and burdens and quality of life. So there's really no empirical basis for assuming patients would want everything. Rely on our physician colleagues. Well, they're certainly the most knowledgeable about the medical situation. They're well qualified to make the medical decision. And again, that's not different than what we normally do in regular practice. We all rely on our physicians to advise us about what intervention makes sense medically. So it's not inconsistent with normal practice. On the other hand, at least in a typical academic medical center, I think it's the case that physicians rarely represent the patient's culture, values, religion, what have you. They are subject to professional bias. You know, the old, when your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail influence, you know. There's at least, we have seen, you know, a serious reluctance to take that responsibility. That's a big responsibility, and many physicians are not comfortable with that, and rightly so. And there is the conflict of interest from time and pressures and freeing up the ICU bed and what have you. So that option wasn't so hot. So then we went to review by the ethics committee. That has the benefit of wide, evaluation. Benefits from the varieties there. There's no one person's bias that can determine the outcome, and less potential for conflict of interest. On the other hand, full ethics committees can take a couple of days to assemble. Not every hospital has an ethics committee, and it typically is composed of heavily on hospital staff who, again, have that same issue with conflict of interest. So that's not a perfect solution. So what we came down to is what we call a facilitated ethics review that would meet these two criteria. That first of all, it has to be able to be done quickly, efficiently, and it has to have lay representation, which again is not a magic bullet, but it at least addresses the potential that as hospital employees and health professionals, we might all be biased. Obviously, we still can't report. We don't know this patient. We may or may not represent the patient's culture and religion, what have you. We're not stakeholders. Yes, we'll certainly focus on best interest, but so will all these other options. But we think by having the lay representation who are not hospital staff or employees, we have lessened at least the potential for conflict of interest. So this is the what we did. We first, drafted a procedure. We reviewed it with our full ethics committee. We had our friends in the law department go over it. And then, because there is no actual statute about this, we contacted the magistrate of the probate court, ran it by him, and got his sanction for it. So it's not in writing, there's no law, but we at least made sure that he was aware of it and he would agree with it. And since that court does not want to hear these cases, he was more than happy to have us do it. So initially we kept it at the guideline level so we could get some experience, see if it worked. And then eventually when we were comfortable with that, we transitioned it into formal policy and incorporated it into our clinical ethics policy. So this is how it works. After the medical team determines that the patient lacks capacity and the social worker has done a good search for surrogates, somebody requests an ethics consultation. The ethics consultant contacts two of our community members. And obviously we're very fortunate that we have, 8 or 10 community members on our ethics committee. So we just start down the list, get the first two who are available. We review with the treatment team the medical issues, the decisions to be made, anything we can find out about that patient's quality of life, call the nursing home where the patient was, find out how they were doing, if they ever talked with anybody about it. And then we make a recommendation to the treatment team that we believe, as best as we can determine, would be the intervention or the withholding of an intervention that's in the patient's best interest. If our procedure outlines that if our subcommittee cannot reach consensus, or if we make a recommendation and the attending physician is not in accord with it and objects, then we call a full ethics committee review, and that usually takes a few days. If there were still to be lack of consensus, then we would refer it to the chief medical officer, who would be the option of last resort. We document the recommendation in the medical record. If it's a procedure that is being authorized, the ethics consultant will sign the consent form indicating reviewed by PWP committee, authorizing the procedure. And then, there's always more to the story with discharge planning and what have you, and we rely on our social worker colleagues for that. I'm going to give you, this is just a really quick overview. On Sunday, Dr. Griggins is going to do a full presentation of our 10-year experience with what we've seen in terms of the kind of patients and the kind of cases and questions. So those of you who are interested in learning more about this, please do go to that session. So we get about 20 to 30 calls a year. About half of those sometimes result in eventually finding family. If we call our local police, have them go to the apartment house, knock on doors. Sometimes it's a son who was on vacation that week, and tincture of thyme helps us a lot in this. So about half of those calls, eventually we don't need the committee, we find somebody. Of all of the calls, if you just take all of those, about a third of them are end of life decisions. Once you winnow out those ones where we do finally find somebody, it's maybe half of the true, what we call the true patient without proxy situations. And just to show you that, these are not all withdrawal or withholding situations. These are some of the procedures we've authorized through the use of the PWP. We've had two cases that we've had some contention and just discomfort among the committee, and we elected to call the full ethics committee. But we've had no cases in which it had to go to the next step of going to the chief medical officer. We've always been able to get some resolution of it. And that's it. And I think we're going to hold questions till the very end. So. Okay, Marty, I'll get you set up.
Thank you, Barb, very much. What our plan is to, as Barb just indicated, to have the three of us make our presentations, and we're fortunately on time at this point, so we certainly hope that we'll have 15 or 20 minutes, maybe even a little longer, for some conversation. So as the third panelist, I want to report that also at our hospital, main campus of the Cleveland Clinic, we have a policy, a document that guides us, not as long as at university hospitals in Cleveland, but it was a policy that was approved in 2009. So we have about 6.5 years experience. We revised that just about a year and a half ago. For internal reasons, the document was downgraded from a policy to a standard operating procedure. But again, that doesn't mean that it was viewed as as not having value. It really was just a kind of an internal documentation redesignation. Barb's hospital and ours, we are in the same state, we are in the same county, and so relative to the state of Ohio, in a real surprising way, we have no surrogate decision-making law in our state. But as Barb indicated, we have legally authorized surrogates for end-of-life decision-making, and this is our listing of our hierarchy. What you don't see there, and that Thad noted earlier, is anyone beyond a blood relative. So a friend. I think some states might even have a clergy person, but we don't have that. What we have adopted based on this is relative to informed consent. We've assumed, and our legal officers have done this, is that if this is good enough in the state of Ohio for end-of-life decision-making, it ought to be a similar hierarchy for informed consent. So we have used this, again, even though there is no legal authorization. So at our hospital, what we have done is, in creating this document, this policy, now a standard operating procedure, is divided medical decisions into three categories. So we, and a lot hinges, of course, on informed consent and on end-of-life decision-making. So we've said there are a lot of decisions that are made at the bedside that are routine medical care that doctors do, nurses do, and informed consent is not for anyone else. Informed consent is not expected and used, and so that's one category. Category number two, medical treatment requiring informed consent but not related to foregoing life-sustaining treatment. And then our third category is decisions regarding withholding and withdrawing, subdivided into do not resuscitate orders and withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment. So that's the framework that we have been using for the relative to these patients without surrogates, patients without proxies, for the last 6.5 years. Some common threads that are built into this, and some terms certainly that have been used already. The foundation of all of this is generally trying to promote patients' best interests. And then to the extent that we can tease out from anyone, if anyone can be found who is a friend or an acquaintance and can give us something about who this patient is and the patient's lifestyle and activities of daily living, to at least cobble together some version of some indications of a substituted judgment. The second bullet here I'll come back to, but we have significantly built into our process a role for social workers, and I'll describe this further a little later, but rigorous efforts by our social workers to try to find surrogates or friends, anyone who can give us some information about the patient. And then as you'll see, and definitely I will acknowledge up front, our system is not a perfect one. Is there room for bias? Absolutely. But as we move on in terms of the decisions, the weightier decisions with greater consequences, some gradated system of additional safeguards. So relative to Category 1, for routine medical care, physician of record simply makes these decisions, and once such a patient has been identified, it triggers a social work consult to try as best we can to locate either a legal or an ethical surrogate. Built into the document is that if there is any kind of questions that arise relative to routine medical care, if there are concerns or questions, that can trigger an ethics consult. In 6.5 years of doing this, that has never happened. For good or bad, make your own judgment about that, but in terms of routine medical care, it's never, concerns have not been brought to the ethics consultation service. So for decisions requiring consent, our category number 2, we require, and there's an assumption here that some intervention, some treatment is being recommended by a primary physician, by an attending, that a required written concurring second opinion by a staff physician, and we have intentionally ruled out trainees of residents or fellows. We think this is weighty enough that we would want a staff physician to weigh in on this. Social work keeps doing their thing, and throughout the whole process, as we continue to try to make decisions in the best interest of the patient. And our additional piece for Category 2 is that a required ethics consult is a piece of this. And so we, at the main campus of the Cleveland Clinic, we use primarily an individual consultant model, and so the individual consultant who is on call is notified and is expected and does review the situation, review the case, begin to talk to both physicians who are involved, look at the documentation, and from an ethics perspective, weigh in on whether this proposed intervention and treatment should go forward. Similar, Barb gave a couple of examples of these kind of interventions, very, very similar. You know, some kind of a surgery, many times diagnostic procedures of a bronchoscopy or an echocardiogram. We had one patient that went for aortic valve replacement based on this category number 2, a foot surgery, pegs and trachs and so on. And then our third category, as I indicated earlier, we subdivide into do not resuscitate orders and then withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment. So 3A, similar, very, very similar to Category 2, is a concurring second opinion, social work keeps doing their thing, and a required ethics consult. But if there is a perception that there is not a sufficient ethical support for the writing of a do not resuscitate order, the order in our policy, in our procedure, cannot be written. And then relative to withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment, and here's where some amount of gradation of safeguards, a required second opinion, and then a review of by a subcommittee of our ethics committee before life-sustaining treatment can be withdrawn. I mentioned earlier these rigorous efforts by our social workers. This is what we say and kind of charge our social workers. This is very, if there were any of them here today, they would say this can be very labor-intensive, that the social worker will make rigorous efforts to identify family members, friends, prior health care providers who may have information about the prior indications of the patient's wishes, values, and priorities. To assist our social workers, we've identified some possible strategies that they could utilize to try to achieve this and identify those family members or friends. Some of them are probably pretty obvious, but we have included this as part of our standard operating procedure to guide our social workers. So certainly reviewing the medical record, searching the patient's belongings and wallet and handbag, doing internet searches for family and neighbors with cautions. I'll mention that in a moment, but trying to use the internet, contacting governmental agencies. You know, is there a previous case that's out there that no one is aware of with Adult Protective Services or our Department of Children and Family Services? Does somebody know something about this patient that we do not know? Reviewing government websites, court dockets, and probate court. Has this person even back, you know, looking for marriage license, looking for divorce decrees? Will that give us some indication of who this patient is and who's out there who can speak for the patient? Occasionally, and it sounds like at UH, they have at university hospitals, contacting our hospital police, who then will contact some local police departments and actually go to doors and go to homes and see what they can find out relative to those individuals. The caution around website and people finders, of course, there's accuracy, there's HIPAA issues, at least in the United States, and privacy, definitely privacy issues. What we have learned, bullet number two, I think, tries to highlight this, is that there are some of our social workers have become so good at this and some amount of mentoring of other social workers. And so having social workers review what they've done to date with a manager, talking to colleagues, especially senior colleagues, to get additional ideas of how can we locate a surrogate. And then, of course, documenting everything in the patient's medical record. So in terms of what our experience has been, this is 68 months worth of data that these next two slides that I'll share with you from May of 2009, and this is all exclusively on our main campus, which is currently now a 1,200 bed hospital. We have 8 community hospitals that are part of the Cleveland Clinic hospital system. None of this data reflects this, but over the last 2 years, this same standard operating procedure has been rolled out, approved by their medical executive committees, and is now used in our community hospitals as well. This data only reflects the main campus of the Cleveland Clinic. But you see, in terms of non-ICU versus ICU patients, so we have a total here of 103 times where this standard operating procedure, this policy has been used. What this reflects, our in this 68-month period, we have had just slightly more than 1,800 ethics consults. So we're averaging 26 to 27 consults a month. What this comes down to is about 1 to 2 consults per month on average for these kind of patients. So regarding what Thad said earlier, it's certainly for us, I think, is certainly a current concern. What we haven't noted in our 6.5 years is whether we have trends that this is increasing yet. But the demographics that you shared with us, Thad, certainly would make us think that it's going to. So we average about 1 to 2 such consults per month. here's some of the outcomes that we have had. In 15 of these cases, and these aren't going to add up to 103 because some of these things were outcomes, multiple outcomes in this list for a single patient. In 15 of our cases, the patient regained decision-making capacity and could begin to make their own decisions. Again, a little further down the line. Every time that happens, the patient is encouraged, strongly encouraged, to complete a healthcare power of attorney, but in only 8 situations did that occur. To the credit of our social workers, in 40, so basically 39% to 40% of our cases down the line, after some amount of decisions had to be made for this patient, some kind of an authorized surrogate was identified. We too, like university hospitals, have learned that initiating guardianship processes are terribly time-consuming, can be expensive, and so that is not our first resort to try to go to court. But in 8 of our cases, we at least that was initiated, but I don't think in any of the cases was it completed by the time either the patient died or the patient was discharged. In terms of Category 2 decisions, those non-end-of-life issues, and I gave you some examples of those earlier. We had 30 such examples in 23 of the cases. DNR orders were written, and then in 5 of our cases, life-sustaining treatment was withdrawn. I'm going to rapidly give you an example of one of these life-sustaining treatments, and in the end, I think we'll still have 15 minutes for a conversation with you. So, disguised, but imagine, but the core is accurate here. Mr. B, 60 years old, he's a nursing home resident, and at least as of the day he showed up at our emergency center, he was full code and was admitted with tonic-clonic seizures. He's intubated in the emergency center. He has a PEA arrest. They do CPR for 10 minutes, ends up in our MICU, Levofed, he's unresponsive, continues to have seizures. Over time, it's figured out, he has a seizure disorder, he has TB, and he has a diagnosis that didn't come with him of a terminal lung cancer over a year ago, and images show that this is consistent with metastases to his brain and bone. Imagine he arrives in our emergency center on a Tuesday. He was scheduled to go to hospice on a Wednesday, the next day, but did not. And no one had changed his code status in the nursing home, and so he has these tonic-clonic seizures, and then 911 is called, and he is brought to our emergency center. In terms of rigorous efforts, no known relatives. There's some indication that the patient has been homeless and vulnerable, estranged from family who may be living in another state. In our medical record, there's an emergency contact, but that phone is disconnected. No one can be found. His primary care provider is contacted and simply describes him as a loner, and no one ever came into the office with him. 2 other hospitals have treated him. They were contacted. They have no record of family. The admitting hospice has no record of any family information. And a community nurse who was involved with the patient recounts he had lived in a homeless shelter for years and had no known family. So following our procedure in Category 3A, a DNR order is written to physicians, supported by our ethics consultation service. At this point, he's dependent on mechanical ventilation due to sedation to control his seizures. We at this point have no evidence of his healthcare preferences and goals, and his prognosis is that over time, he is expected to continue to deteriorate based on his lung cancer. Appreciate this thin description that I'm giving you is really happening over multiple days, probably very, very close to 2 weeks. And then our ethics committee, subcommittee meets. they said a lot more than just this, but we agree that it would be ethically appropriate to withdraw mechanical ventilation and pressors if he does not make clear progress toward being weaned from these interventions in the next few days. An attempt at lightening his sedation, weaning him from the ventilator, and extubating him is appropriate. If he is successfully extubated, we agree that designating him DNR comfort care, shifting to a comfort care mode, would be appropriate. In the end, he could not be weaned from the ventilator, and so ventilation was, he was provided appropriate analgesia, and ventilation was discontinued. So, thank you for putting up with the three of us up to this point. I'm going to invite Thad and Barb to come up, and let's engage in some conversation. Thanks. Oh. A lot of hands. Yes. We may have to, because this is true of all of you. Okay. Very good. We'll use this mic. We'll try to circulate that mic.
Testing. Yes.
Okay.
Are there times when you have turned down the DNR or the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatments?
Yeah. For the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment, there have been one or two cases where we actually didn't take it to a subcommittee that was being proposed, and we did not go that far. Relative to the DNR orders, as in my recollection, the answer is no.
And training for the community members who are doing, Barb, your work.
When we started this, you know, we had community members already on the committee. We've always had a fair number of community members. So the training consisted of meeting with them, reviewing the policy, the expectations, then having them just accompany a PWP meeting to observe and get some experience with it. So, you know, in fact, something Dr. Griggins will talk about on Sunday is we've just recently done an evaluation of this, and one of their feedbacks was they would appreciate even more a more structured orientation. Yeah. I have to say, too, these are not, I mean, we're very fortunate we live in an academic community, and so the people who are community members are not, you know, your mother's neighbor. You know, there are people on faculties of different universities and people who have gotten masters in some other field. So they're very knowledgeable individuals, but not healthcare people and not employees. So I think if we had sort of true average community members, we would require a much different orientation.
Hi. So this is mostly for Thad. This, I know you're up on things. In California, we have Canner versus Chapman. That kind of altered our circumstances, and I just wanted to give you maybe an opportunity to talk about that a bit.
Well, we might get too detailed, but I mean, it's like I mentioned, I'll just give a quick. Hardly any states have developed, you know, legislatively or regulatorily a mechanism, right? So you guys just had, like you said, you had to invent it on your own. You're not really consistent or authorized under Ohio law to do what you're doing. Other places have done that, like Santa Clara has done that. For the long-term care context in the state of California, they, years, decades ago, actually created a mechanism which the long-term care community thought worked very well, but the California Association for Nursing Home Reform had that statute declared unconstitutional. So, and perhaps it wasn't as, in other words, basically they used IDTs, an interdisciplinary team, to make decisions on behalf of unbefriended patients in a California long-term care facility. But in practice, they deviated from where the statutes. In other words, it wasn't supposed to be for life-sustaining treatment. It wasn't supposed to be for the, like Marty broke up into categories. It was supposed to be for routine treatment. You're supposed to try to involve a community member, but in general, it's all employees. And so I think what happened is, in practice, they deviated from the original intent of the statute. And so things in California are a little bit unsettled right now.
Yes. We're handing around the microphone.
Sure. call back. We implemented something similar, I think, based on actually combinations of work of everybody up here, but have struggled with the language in the chart because we started with what some recommended language have been about administrative authorization, so we weren't pretending we were doing informed consent, but our legal department was not comfortable with that, and we've just gone back to doing just basically recommendations from the ethics committee. I don't know if you could comment on some specific wording that you use in your documentation that explains or says what you're offering.
I would say that in general we avoid language of informed consent because it's not, and because it is physician authorized treatment that is found, you know, I think frequent terms we often use are ethically supportable for the following reasons when the ethics consultation service is asked to weigh in. So we don't have standardized language around this, but I will say that we don't use informed consent.
We also don't, you know, we're trying to be careful that we don't act as if we're giving informed consent, but we do use the term recommended. You know, the PWP committee has met and recommended XYZ, and if we sign the form, we'll sign it as authorized by the PWP committee. And that's been okay with our lawyers.
I'm curious about the Category 2 consults. I think at my hospital, if we had required ethics consultation for the Category 2, we would be inundated with things like lines or CTs with contrast, things like that. So I guess I'm curious if you know whether you're really getting consulted on all of those cases and what the level of detail... level of detail you're reviewing.
And one of the things I should have said, kind of in explaining the data that we have, the data comes from our, that I shared with you, comes from our ethics consultation database. So these are the consults that we know about, or these are the patients that we know about for which we have been consulted. So I could only speculate, you know, to what extent there are many, many more patients. What I will say, though, after 6.5 years of doing this, I think the consciousness of this policy has had good permeation within our hospital, and I think within our community hospitals as well, because we have done a number in our community hospitals. One of our regional ethicists is here today, has done a lot of in-services around this, and some printed materials and so on. So we probably aren't missing a lot. I would also, my last comment would be that when I crunched the numbers, I was surprised at the low number of Category 2. I would expect that to be much, much higher, but it's, the data is what it is. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. Paul Schneider from the Veterans Hospital in Los Angeles. I just wanted to say more of a statement. We perhaps do more than 50% of our ethics consults on this subject. And we are the ones that are inundated that she was afraid of. So that I am sort of immured to it. It's no longer extraordinary. And I wonder if that resonates with you all, the idea that this is normal, not an extraordinary kind of issue, and that we probably do need to build much more infrastructure, legal infrastructure and organizational support for dealing with this.
Wow. Again, and I'm presuming that may reflect your patient population, but 50% seems overwhelming to me. And I also know, maybe a bit of an advertisement for everybody, the VA, you have your own policy and procedure around this issue that I... Okay, so...
Just one comment, Paul. As a researcher, there's maybe a few dozen people who have published, you know, multi-year summaries of what their ethics consults are on. Nobody hardly ever breaks it out. So I was, they'd say problem with surrogate decision making, right? And so, as somebody who's trying to bring more attention to this, whether it's from policymakers or otherwise, it's hard to make the sell to them, this is important, this is a big problem, you should pay attention to it, if you don't have any really good data. So it would be great if, you know, when people publish their summaries of what their ethics councils have been for the last 10 years, if they could break this out in the way that Marty and Barb have.
Good point. Yeah. And again, the microphone's being passed around, so, yeah.
I had a question about, I always feel like in these situations, usually about the Category 2 with major surgeries or major interventions, that an unrepresented patient is refusing or not cooperating with, that sometimes we decide to try to get a court order and sometimes we don't. There just doesn't seem to be any clear parameters into as to when we should be doing that or not.
Yeah.
You know, our experience actually is most of these people are not objecting. You know, they are not able to express a wish at all. Occasionally we get someone who is objecting and we're very reluctant to do something to a patient who is actively saying no, even if they lack capacity for a good judgment. I mean, we're very reluctant to do anything more against that person's expressed wishes. So I can't think of any time in the 10 years we've been doing this that we've ever gone to court for a court order. You know, we call our committee and we get their best judgment about it and we proceed on that basis, but I can't right offhand, can't think of a case where we've, you know, laid hands on somebody who was saying no, even if it was a life and death kind of decision. So
I would just say ditto in terms of both things, that, you know, if somebody lacking decision-making capacity nonetheless is uncooperative and objecting, I mean, we generally don't tie those patients down and force treatment on them and find a variety of other strategies. And then the other thing, and maybe it's reflective of the fact our hospital's only a mile away from each other. We're in the same county, and we have the same experience with our county court system. They don't want to see us. And so we've developed our own internal process. So within your own local jurisdictions, things may be different.
I have two questions, and I'll make a comment first. I do think that the regional variations in the laws make it very difficult for us, because if we have a number of people in my hospital who trained in New York, the laws are different than they are in New Jersey. With that said, most of our surrogacy questions lately have been exactly this issue, and the patients are coming from residential facilities where they may have been residents for many, many, many years, and some of these are group homes for psychiatric patients, and not one of those facilities has ever sought guardianship or surrogacy. And I think it's nice for us to talk about this in the room, but from my perspective, they have an ethical and moral imperative that they do something about this, because they send them off to the hospital when they know that they're not capable of even signing the consent to be admitted and treated. And I'd like your comments on that. I'd also like the comments, because this came up this week, is we have an undocumented alien immigrant, or we believe him to be undocumented. We're not exactly sure what his right name and date of birth are. Nobody knows. His only known address is a vacant lot. And so the question is, what tools can we give our social services people when they run into a roadblock like that? And I think in our county, we have a large Hispanic population that has come from Guatemala, Mexico, originally to work in the farms, and now they are there. And they don't have a voice, they don't often have family, and they certainly don't have surrogates.
We're gonna accept that as a very important comment and description of where how challenging these cases can be.
This is a comment. It's not a question. But where I work, there is a large homeless population. And the problem that can arise with this population is not so much decision-making, but what do you do in the context of discharge planning? Mm-hmm. All right,
I'm glad to hear the murmur of appreciation.
Right.
Because that is these people are unbefriended. Okay, they do not belong in hospitals for any number of reasons. But for even more important reasons, they don't belong in a vacant lot.
Right. For safe discharge, right?
Hi. So I was thinking, going forward with this problem and making progress on further solutions, it might be helpful on the level of theoretical justification to clarify the ethical paradigms that you invoke. So you start with an autonomy paradigm where it's authorization of treatment that's a problem. So self-determination is at stake. But then when it becomes clear that self-determination cannot happen, you slip into a prevention of harm paradigm. So all the arguments that you offered for why some of the options are preferable to others are prevention of harm arguments. So in fact, you use the thing of a hammer and a nail and so on. We are so enamored with informed consent that we try to fix the problem into an informed consent paradigm, when in fact it is a harm paradigm. We're trying to prevent harm to this patient, to this vulnerable patient. So I think being explicit about the paradigm we're using and the ethical framework we're using will help us get to a morally acceptable solution.
No, I agree 100%. And in fact, in the report we wrote for the Journal of Clinical Ethics, that's exactly what we came down to, doing a sterile ethical analysis. It is really the duty of non-maleficence that is the strongest ground for the decisions. I think you're absolutely right, so I agree.
Just to give Barb and Cynthia some publishing credit, I think it was in 2006 in the Journal of Clinical Ethics that they published their paradigm that they use. So certainly those of you that are interested and want to access some literature, do so. So we've come to the end of our hour. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And
mark your calendar now for the 18th annual meeting of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, coming up October 6th through 9th of 2016 in Washington, D.C. This is a production of Roland Recording.